You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Thursday, 30 July. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, we've got Alex Dace, who'll be talking that FOMAC meeting as well as Sasol and EOH updates. We're talking to V&A Waterfront on food courts and their cruise terminal, even as cruise lines remain grounded, and Cannon Asset Managers on avoiding the herd when investing, essentially going back to basics. The show is proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. So, morning headlines, business day. Standard Bank takes first punch from pandemic on the chin. And CNBC, Fed holds rates steady, says economic growth is well below pre-pandemic levels. Morning markets, US was green, S&P up 1.2, NASDAQ up 1.4, Asia mixed, Sydney up 0.8, Turkey off 0.1%. Commodities, again, mixed, again, oil a little red, and again, gold up 19.59, Rand a little weaker at 16.57, and top 40 opening call for a slightly green open up 0.1%.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Alex Dace. He's a portfolio manager at Mthombo Wealth. Alex, appreciate your time last night. Let's kick off with that Federal Open Monetary Policy Committee. I suppose no surprises. Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, essentially keeping rates where they are at 0 to 0.25%, and saying, and I quote him, "We are committed to using our full range of tools to support our economy in this challenging environment." Staying on script for the Federal Reserve.
Yes, good morning, Simon. So yeah, the start is really that the monetary policy will remain very, very loose. You know, so it's all going to be about fiscal stimulus really going forward to see recovery in U.S. markets. But based on this monetary decision yesterday, it should be positive for equities. But I also think the fact that they're going to do whatever it takes to really try to short the market really means that you could probably continue to see the dollar under pressure. Mm-hmm. You know, and perhaps even good for commodities like gold going forward as well.
Yeah, dollar has been under pressure, particularly against the euro. And this is perhaps more a case of dollar pressure rather than euro strength. And I know there's a nuances there, but it's an important nuance where we're seeing that dollar weakness, which is truthfully unusual, but not in the light of the Fed's response.
Yeah, so if you look at the dollar index, it's about 2-year lows, red to euro, give or take, and a couple of other currencies as well. So certainly weakness from that perspective. And it's due to the really unprecedented amount of stimulus packages that the U.S. has done. So a little bit of confidence dropped there from the markets, but this could reverse again at some stage. We don't really know. Mm-hmm. But if you take back to history, also a few years past the financial crisis, around about 2011 or so, the dollar was also incredibly weak after all the huge stimulus packages that was there. So if we could perhaps go back into that type of direction, that, of course, will be very good for precious metals.
Yeah, good for precious metals, and not necessarily a long-term trend, but certainly can persist for a while. Coming back home, Sasol's selling one of their chemical plants in Secunda, $8.5 billion they're selling it for. Market really liked it. In the short term, I see why. It helps their balance sheet. It gets rid of some of that large amount of debt. We're still waiting the trading update, which apparently will only be next week. We're still waiting news on the LCCP, the Lake Charles chemical project. My issue with the asset sales, essentially, it's that they're selling something. They're the only customer. Longer term, it's going to hurt them a bit. But Sasol's focus right now needs to be on fixing that balance sheet.
Yeah, so Sasol needs to reduce their balance sheet or the debt about $6 billion end of next year. So they can try to do that by roughly about $2 billion through cash preservation, which is going to be very difficult. Probably $1 billion through non-core asset sales, and the other $3 billion needs to be a function of the Lake Charles sale as well as the shortfall by rights issue. So there's still a lot of uncertainties in there. But getting back to this particular sale, so it seems like it's going to be like a sell and lease back. So that means that, you know, it's very likely that the cost going forward could be high. I mean, so it probably will be a cost plus. I haven't disclosed these numbers yet. And also, imagine the replacement costs. If Sasol ever wanted to build their own vertical integrated system to place in infrastructure again, the cost would probably be multiples of this $8.5 billion sale. So it's certainly, I don't think necessarily a good thing for the business, but they need, of course, to do this to store the balance sheet. So that's certainly a step in the right direction. That's why markets like it. But still, I think from a value destruction perspective, it does seem questionable.
Yeah, as you say, at this point, it's the balance sheet and the debt that they're looking at. $6 billion, 100 billions are big numbers there. Standard Bank, the first of the big banks, coming out with their trading update, looking at headline earnings 30 to 50% down. I think broadly, we'd be expecting some numbers like this. We've seen Liberty doing a big provision, which will actually take them into a loss. Of course, Standard Bank owns a significant chunk there. I thought on the surface, actually, you know, 30 to 50% down, taking that Liberty details into account, I thought not a bad update. The market certainly liked it as well.
Yeah, so in the banking space, you're probably going to see all the companies reporting results down roughly in the region of 50%. So anything less than that will probably be good. They did not include the impairments to the IT spending and so forth. You know, that's some extent you have to say, well, they spent so much money on this over the last few years, perhaps some of it needs to be incorporated in your earnings number. But yeah, other than that, I think it certainly seems to be slightly better than the market was saying. So that is why the share price was up. But we still need to wait a lot more details. I think banks is going to probably have to play quite a societal role going forward. And as a result, their path to recovery is going to, normality is going to be probably a lot slower than other sectors in the economy.
Quick last update, EOH, there were two stories. There was the JSE Sensor. I want to touch on their update as well. Fairly positive. If nothing else, they're now cash flow positive. That's a big deal for them. That was for the second half. EOH, it's a long road back to normality for them, but it does seem that they're on that path. They're on that road to getting things back to normal for the business.
Agreed. I think the management and the new board have done a good job so far. I'm certainly cleaning up from a governance perspective and trying to be a lot more transparent with the market. Most of the debt reduction so far has been through asset sales. And they've been trying to improve operational performance by increasing their cash flows and so forth. So that's really the next key for them, is to try to start growing the business organically once again, and specifically getting that EBITDA numbers up into positive free cash flow so that they can actually pay down that debt. And that could theoretically lead to a massive re-rating and stop if they can't be successful in that.
Yeah, maybe they got the easy part done, hard part to come, but they've got a good management team in place. Alex Dace, Portfolio Manager on Thimble Wealth, appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting now with David Green. He's the CEO at the V&A Waterfront, undoubtedly South Africa's premier tourist destination, and I suppose shopping centre. It is a shopping centre, although it's giant, and there's multiple different precincts, one of them being the cruise ship precinct. David, your cruise ship's obviously not operating. We'll touch on that in a moment. You're expanding the cruise terminal. You're bringing in a food emporium. In one sense, it's like we're in the middle of a pandemic, but I suppose this process probably started, you know, pre-pandemic, and obviously you're thinking beyond in terms of expanding and sort of catering not just to cruise liners but to the broader sort of foot traffic at the V&A.
That's absolutely right. Morning, Simon. You're absolutely right. Yeah, this project's been probably about a year and a half in the making, and we were probably about 12 months into construction when COVID-19 broke. And I think like most companies, when COVID-19 broke, you pause, you look at your strategy, you put certain projects on ice, and you determine whether you proceed with them. This particular one, it's due to open in December, January. I think our thinking is it's a long-term project. With a bit of good fortune, the market will be starting to open up. We will be starting to attract locals. It's a big space. Be able to kind of eat with social distancing, and again, there is the possibility that cruise line traffic will also start up around that time. So, yeah, it was a difficult decision, but I think the long term nature of the project and the attractiveness of the project and the need for these kind of new projects led us to continue with it.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned locals. I mean, obviously, it's going to be at the cruise terminal, but it will be for locals. It's going to be quite an event. And of course, food in of itself is fairly highly and it employs a lot of people. And it's not just the chefs on site and the servers and the like on site. It's that entire chain of process and actually going to be generating employment, generating interest, generating sort of cuisine, local cuisine, and getting people back into sort of normal. Normalcy to a degree.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, the key part of the project is a food incubator, which is a new concept to South Africa. We picked it up in there's one in San Francisco, La Cachina, and Amsterdam, and we've been working with them. What it is I mean, appreciating the kind of rich diversity of South African cuisine. But often there's a lot of people have ideas, either a product concept or a restaurant concept, but there's a huge difficulty in them being able to kind of bridge that gap between taking, let's say, their product to commercialize it into commercial stores, or if you measure somebody who has a restaurant idea to actually take on a lease to buy the equipment, staff, etc., the big bridge, big gap. So what this does is it's a large shared communal kitchen. We'll be seeking applications for people with food ideas and concepts, very much grassroots level. They have to sort of stage one concept. Mm-hmm. We then put them through a 6-month cohort intensive training period with chefs and kind of commercial experience, and then give them an opportunity to commercialize either their product or in pop-up restaurants. And then surrounding that, we're going to have a series of, again, kind of smaller scale producers, artisans, what I call the kind of the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the cheesemonger, the distillery. And they will be sort of supporting this food incubation ecosystem, providing their expertise. But equally, they'll be commercializing their product and running a business. So we're looking for it to employ in excess of 150 people. And exactly as you say, at the end of COVID, there's probably people looking to kind of restart a business or to take a business forward. So I think there'll be quite a strong demand, and there is this amazing rich diversity of kind of different food concepts and ideas. So we're hoping we're going to get some great ideas and then allow them to kind of grow and scale their businesses.
Back to cruise ships. I mean, obviously the cruise industry is in hiatus and it's under lockdown in of itself. But pre sort of pandemic, how many cruise ships were coming into the V&A harbour on an average year, and how many passengers does that relate into?
Yeah, we for a number of years we sort of bumped along around the kind of I kind of generally talk in passenger, around the sort of 50 to 60,000 passengers. We built this terminal about 3 years ago. The cruise business up pre-COVID, you have to start pre and post-COVID. Mm-hmm. Pre-COVID was growing very fast. That's the fastest growing area within tourism. And this year, we had 100,000 booked. And for the season basically runs from October through to May. So for the season has just passed to May, we had 100,000. And for the coming one, which would be starting into now, we had 200,000. And then there was the expectation of go to 300. So it really was taking off in a big way. And what was happening was that the major cruise companies, they were relocating their vessels from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. They were sort of creating routes around Durban, Indian Ocean, all the way up to Walvis Bay, Namibia, and these kind of regular cruises. So it's a very interesting area of business. I think we are pretty confident it will come back. Mm-hmm. There's a huge amount of investment. The cruise lines are big businesses. A huge amount of investment has gone in. And I think the cruise liners companies will create an environment that people feel safe. And what's interesting for me is that people who go on cruises, there's a very strong loyalty. 6 out of 10 will go on a repeat cruise. And the cruise liners are saying that even now, they have quite strong bookings coming up. So, yeah, I think it's good for South Africa, the cruise business and international tourism business. But it's just like all these businesses, just when people feel safe to be able to travel.
Yeah, it's that safety, but that's a big number, 100,000. That is a very giant number. David Green, CEO of V&A Waterfront, appreciate your early morning. When you protect your monthly income against the risk of injury, illness and death, you protect your future and the impact you make on those around you. FMI has been protecting South Africans' income for over 25 years, constantly innovating to provide greater claim certainty and cover for more occupations than ever before. Make your impact, protect your income first. FMI, life done better. FMI, a division of Bidvest Life, is a licensed life insurer and authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Kaliso Pakisi. He's an investment manager at Cannon Asset Managers. Morning, appreciate your time. Talking sort of, you phrase it, kicking the tires. And before we get to that, I mean, your note you put out was a lot of around Hertz, which was, when it was happening, one of the craziest things we saw. A company in bankruptcy, Chapter 11, stock up hundreds of percents. I mean, with respect to the buyers, and maybe they were making some money on it, I mean, they really were, you know, this was speculating rather than sort of good old-fashioned in investing. There's very little investment case for buying a company in a bankruptcy process.
Good morning, Simon. Yes. I mean, what is happening or what has happened with Hertz is something that we've never seen before. I mean, even the word unprecedented doesn't begin to describe it. When a company goes or files for bankruptcy, that immediately tells you that the company is worth zero. But I think what investors were banking on is that the second largest rental car company in the world still had a fleet of vehicles. So surely investors would still get something once this is done and dusted. But what we saw, as you mentioned, is opportunistic traders. So you can imagine if you are a trader or someone who's willing to take the risk and make quick profits, I come to you and I tell you, I just made a trade on Hertz and I made 200%. So you probably will say, oh my God, if you've done it, why can't I? So you saw people out of fear of missing out, jumping onto this trade. Well, some of them were lucky to make some gains, but I don't think all of them were. So yeah. That's pretty much what happened, yeah.
I like that. It was a FOMO trade. And yeah, many made money, probably more didn't. I mean, it goes back to, in a sense, I mean, it's good old-fashioned investing. And you know, you made a couple of points in your article, and the two that stood out to me. And, you know, it's how does the company make money, and will it continue to make money well into the future? I mean, ultimately, this is what investing is. It's about, where does the cash flow come from, and will the cash flow continue to come? And it's a little bit slower and a little bit more digging, but it fundamentally works. It's about that generating of income for the company.
Correct. And I think most investors are not aware that it's not that hard to get this kind of information. There's company presentations, there's annual reports, which will tell you whether a company is introducing a new product, whether a company is facing challenges and competition. So it's not necessarily that everyone will be an analyst or a valuation expert, but if you understand the basics and if you take your time and do some reading, you'll get all this information that can tell you whether where you're putting your money in is worth it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I like your point. It's not that hard. The data is out there. The other important point, and we've been talking about it quite a bit during the pandemic, is balance sheets are suddenly sort of back in vogue. Suddenly, investors are looking harder at those balance sheets, looking at the liability side, looking at the assets. Can they manage it? Balance sheets always been important, but in scenarios such as Hertz, they go out the window. Truthfully, a balance sheet is, in many senses, a core of a business and gives a good indication of its long-term longevity and profitability and investment case.
Precisely. So we usually in the investment world hear of lazy balance sheets or strong balance sheets, and that's essentially where you need to start. If a company is heavily indebted, for example, and a pandemic happens like what we've seen now, that will tell you whether the company will in the future be able to sustain its going concern. And we ideally, in this kind of situation, would like to have companies that have really strong balance sheets to weather these storms. because should anything happen, for example, like a hack scenario, these companies that are heavily indebted with stretched balance sheets will tend to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing that happen quite a lot now, exposing these companies that have been quite under pressure on the balance sheet side.
Yeah, it's also the current example. We were chatting with Alex at the top of the show. Their balance sheet is actually going to, fixing their balance sheet is going to hurt them over the long term. Kholiso Phakisi, investment analyst, Cannon Asset Managers, appreciate your time. That's it for today. You'll find us live every weekday morning, 6:30 at the MoneyWeb website or the app, podcast from 7 a.m. The show was proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. Massive thanks to my team, Eddie and Cordora, to you for listening, my guests for their morning time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.